mandate as president of the European Central Bank ended after 8 years in 2019. His name emerged as a potential prime minister when the government crisis sparked in Italy in mid-January. The crisis had been triggered by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, whose unexpected decision to withdraw his small party's support to the previous executive had forced Conte to resign.
Con questa speranza,
I am confident that the unity and the capacity to give a responsible response will emerge from the discussion with the parties, with the groups in Parliament. The challenges are to defeat the pandemic, complete the vaccination campaign, offer responses to everyday problems and relaunch the country using the extraordinary resources from the EU.
The country desperately needs to secure an immediate massive injection of liquidity into its staggering economy. Italy has reported its biggest contraction in GDP since the end of World War II following the pandemic. The National Bureau of Statistics estimates the country's economy shrank by almost 9% last year.
What is there to understand is if the next government will be technical or political. This is for Prime Minister designate Draghi to find out. Draghi unusually met with outgoing Prime Minister Conte after receiving the mandate to see if he can also count on his support.
It cannot be taken for granted that a Draghi executive would win substantial backing from parties across the political spectrum. Many five-star movement lawmakers have said they will not vote in favor of a technocrat government led by Draghi, arguing the only possible executive must be a political one.
Also, nationalist Brothers of Italy leader Giorgia Meloni warned her party would not support Draghi as prime minister, calling her lies. The anti-immigrant, anti-EU League party of Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi's centre-right Forza Italia party to abstain any vote for him. Max Civili, Rome.
Russia's Sputnik V vaccine is more than 91% effective against COVID-19. The news was published Tuesday in The Lancet, a British medical journal. This is great news for all the countries already administering the vaccine and all those looking for alternative supplies.
It's unconditionally an epoch-making event. There are four vaccines in the world which published what's called the third phase of trials. Our vaccine is among the three most effective vaccines in the world.
After the announcement, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said every vaccine is welcome in the European Union. The bloc's vaccine rollout is lagging behind the UK and the US, and desperate and disappointed member states, including Hungary, are looking elsewhere for supplies.
The centralized vaccine procurement of Brussels has failed. This is risking the lives of Europeans and the quick relaunching of the European economy. That's why we have looked for new sources of supply. We were the first, but it is unlikely that we will be the only ones in the European Union in this effort.
Armenia, Belarus, and Serbia have already got Sputnik V. European countries which are not EU members and say they were losing out waiting for the COVAX program, which was supposed to make vaccines available to everyone, to deliver. Countries hard hit by Western sanctions have also approved Sputnik V. Venezuela has already received its first shipment, and Iran's first batch is expected any day now. Russia has donated 5,000 doses to the Palestinians in the occupied territories as well. The World Health Organization says to end the COVID-19 pandemic, it has to be ended for everyone, everywhere. Nonetheless, rich countries are hoarding and rolling out vaccines, while the least developed nations watch and wait. It may take years for the poorest to get the jab. Bianca Rahimi, London.
That's the precise number of refugees currently barely surviving in awful conditions on the islands of Greece, apparently a proud member of the 27-nation EU. Legislators have been discussing the situation here in the European Parliament, Brussels.
Most of the time, people are locked up in the camps. Does the Commission think this is imprisonment? And if not, what is the difference between this and imprisonment?
There are not enough toilets or hot showers in the overcrowded camps. EU lawmakers say this is all the more appalling against the backdrop of a global pandemic.
Tents have been set up in October, and only in January they start winterization, as if the arrival of winter was a big surprise. And they're tents. It's very basic.
The Parliament debate heard that 60% of the refugees have reported suicidal thoughts to doctors. On Lesbos alone, there are 129 babies under the age of one. EU nations pledged to take in 5,145 refugees from the islands, but just half that number have been relocated.
There are many people who have now been granted international protection who are still stuck in the camps. What's going to happen with them? Do we have commitment by other member states to take over people, and why is this not happening?
The argument has been made the EU has a special responsibility in this regard because of the very destabilising roles some of the bloc's countries have played in Africa and in the Middle East.
The shape of the current political landscape in the EU does not inject confidence that the bloc's asylum policy will change anytime soon, according to experts.
There is across Europe now this sense that of xenophobia, of populism, of resistance to seeing more migration. So it makes it very, very tough to do.
Lawmakers say EU governments are using the pandemic as a reason to extricate themselves from their fundamental human rights responsibilities. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Almost 7 weeks after the start of the vaccine rollout in the United States, the early data from the COVID vaccination process reveals African Americans and Hispanics, even those working as first responders, are left behind in the vaccination drive. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention examined two priority groups for receiving the first wave of COVID vaccinations. The examined groups were healthcare workers and nursing home residents. According to the CDC, Blacks received over 5% of the jabs despite making up 16% of healthcare workforce and 14% of nursing home residents. Similarly, Hispanics, who make up 11% of healthcare workers, received over 5% of shots. This is while white Americans received over 60% of the shots and accounted for 60% of healthcare workers. The previous CDC data also revealed that Black, non-Hispanic, and Asian healthcare workers in the country were more likely to contract COVID-19 and die from it than white workers. Ironically, America's Black and Hispanic communities are bearing the brunt of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout since its emergence in January last year. They have faced alarming rates of infections and deaths in some states. The trend is particularly visible in the recent CDC analysis, which suggests Blacks, Hispanics, and Native Americans died at nearly three times the rate of white Americans. Health officials have sounded the alarm for months, broadly calling for equity in vaccine distribution and access to the health care. Some experts also say the trend won't change unless the compounding factors that put these groups in disadvantage are addressed. The latest revelation of disparity is just the tip of the iceberg, as minorities in the U.S. have been facing racial bias, even in healthcare, for decades.
Well, I wouldn't say it's surprising. There has been a generational disparity from decade to decade when it comes to medical care for Black Americans and Latinos. We can go back as far as the founding of this country, where there were people who were injured from the Black community, whether it was from beatings, and they were left to die on their own without medical treatment. Fast forward all the way into the 21st century, and we're still seeing these disparities when it comes to the treatment of not just people who are getting vaccinated, but from people who are exposed to COVID-19.
It seems marginalized and minoritized patients have and will suffer more acutely during the COVID-19 crisis in the U.S. because of decades-old bias towards the people of color. The coronavirus has once again unmasked the systematic racism, inequality, and racial gap, putting a question mark in the United States' dogma of being a just and equal society.
Yemenis gathered in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to condemn the international silence toward the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has caused a severe fuel crisis in the war-torn country.
We in the health sector put the responsibility on the coalition countries for the consequences of the oil crisis, as well as the United Nations, which must play its role and pressure the coalition to allow the interests of the oil derivative continues.
The Ministry of Health said the fuel crisis has pushed up the death rate among premature babies in the incubators and caused large quantities of medicines to turn rotten. This is while many health facilities, including dialysis centers, are on the verge of closure due to their inability to generate power.
Oil derivatives are the basis for the work of hospitals and health centers, and a shortage will cause oxygen factories to stop. Hospitals will turn into cemeteries, and intensive care, nurseries, cardiac catheters, and all medical devices will stop. This will increase the number of deaths.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a war on the impoverished country in March 2015, killing thousands of civilians and imposing a siege that has caused more deaths than weapons have. Babies and kidney failure patients are losing their lives every day due to the siege imposed on the country. This comes amid the silence of the international community towards the suffering of the Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Iran's foreign minister has rejected the US president's call on Tehran to return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear accord before Washington ends what Mohammad Javad Zarif called its full economic war on Iran. In an exclusive interview with CNN, Zarif said, even after Iran rolled back its commitments, it remained in full compliance with the accord.
If you read paragraph 36, we acted in strict accordance with the nuclear agreement. Now the United States needs to come back into compliance, and Iran will be ready immediately to respond.
He said the burden is now on the US to prove its credibility.
The side that has not been able to show that it fulfills its promises has been the United States. And as I said, the United States needs to prove its bona fides. We have already proven our bona fides.
Zarif also said Iran is ready to reverse the steps it has taken under the nuclear deal to reduce its cooperation once the US returns to its obligations. Zarif said that it is possible if the coordinator of the deal's joint commission, namely the EU foreign policy chief, synchronizes the steps each side should take.
He can put his hat as the coordinator of the joint position and sort of choreograph the actions that are needed to be taken by the United States and the actions that are needed to be taken by Iran.
Last week, the new U.S. Secretary of State said Iran must return to the limits set by the nuclear deal before Washington makes any move on the accord. Iran started scaling back its commitments in May 2019, exactly a year after then-U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the agreement. Iran did so in response to the pullout and Trump's reimposition of sanctions on Tehran. Iran also cited the failure of the European signatories to compensate for the US pullout and protect Tehran's economic benefits from the nuclear agreement. Iran says those benefits should be served if the US or others want its full cooperation.
This is the first official visit by leaders of Afghanistan's Taliban to Iran. Led by the group's top political leader, Abdul Ghani Baradar, the delegation arrived in Tehran last week upon the invitation of Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. They came to Tehran with the hope that Iran would speed up the slow-paced intra-Afghan talks that has faced stalemate in Qatar.
We ask Iran to facilitate the peace talks between us and the Afghan government. Based on the Doha Agreement, the incumbent government in Afghanistan needs to dissolve and a new government be formed that includes all ethnic and political sects. We believe that a regional country like Iran has a better right to act as a mediator.
The Taliban and the Afghan government have been negotiating in the Qatari capital to reach a peace deal, but to no avail. The peace process started after the U.S. agreed to withdraw 12,000 of its troops from Afghanistan in exchange for the Taliban halting their attacks on international forces under a deal signed between the two sides in early 2020. The Taliban says as long as the U.S. is fighting them, it is not fit to be a neutral mediator.
United States is not mediator.
We had a negotiation with the United States for 18 months and which reached an agreement. And based on the agreement, we have intra-Afghan negotiation. United States is not a mediator because they are the Afghans to decide their destiny and their fate independently without intervention of any country.
Tehran lays emphasis on the need to form an inclusive Afghan government that encompasses all the influential political forces. In his meeting with the Taliban delegates, Iran's foreign minister stressed that different Afghan sides need to sit at the negotiating table to resolve Afghanistan's woes. Iran had also had similar meetings with Afghan state officials, where it's voiced its readiness to help promote intra-Afghan talks as the ultimate way to restoring peace and stability to the war-wrecked country.
Taliban leaders echo Iran's proposition of an inclusive government, saying this holds the key to the end of the problems gripping Afghanistan. Tehran maintains that this would offer Afghan people the chance to have the final say in their country, a right that has long been seized in the wake of foreign intervention in Kabul's affairs. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain is speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
The debate.
A warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Benjamin Sasha. One more time, a U.S. warship has sailed through the Taiwan Strait, this time under a new administration at the White House. The move has faced objections from China again, which calls it a violation of its sovereignty. The U.S. State Department spokesman says, quote, Washington wants to be in lockstep with allies and partners and then will engage with China. Now, that's while the Chinese foreign ministry says that Beijing is open to reset relations with Washington, arguing that the two countries are at a critical historical juncture after a year of escalating tensions. What's future holding for the two countries' relations?
Tensions between Beijing and Washington escalated once again, this time after the U.S. guided missile destroyer USS John McCain sailed through the Taiwan Strait despite repeated objections from China. The transit was the first such move since the inauguration of Joe Biden as U.S. president. The U.S. Navy claimed the move demonstrates Washington's, quote, commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific, saying that the U.S. military would, quote, continue to fly, sail, and operate anywhere international law allows. Beijing, however, considers any passing through the waterway as provocative and a breach of its sovereignty. It says such operations threaten stability in the region and embolden separatists on the self-ruled island. China is also strongly against deepening ties between Washington and Taipei, since it sees Taiwan as part of its territory. It has repeatedly called on the United States to respect the One China policy and stop interfering in the country's internal affairs. Taiwan, however, views itself an independent territory. The previous U.S. administration under Donald Trump tried to bolster Taiwan's international standing by sending several high-level envoys to the island. It also approved sales of sophisticated weapons to Taipei, including F-16 fighter jets and advanced missiles. The moves drew strong condemnation from China and caused relations between the two countries to sink to the lowest level in decades. With Biden taking the helm at the White House, there was some optimism that Washington-Beijing ties would improve. However, it so appears that there is no end to the downward spiral. Experts believe Biden is also using Taiwan as a playing card against China.
the Biden administration, despite having quite a bit of experience, is treating Taiwan like it's a playing card. Unfortunately, for the on the Chinese side, it's not a playing card, it's a red line. So these are the type of very dangerous situations which can, in fact, lead to an armed conflict.
Taiwan is one of the multiple fronts in the Sino-American standoff. The dueling economic powers have been in loggerheads over a host of issues. The U.S. has recently blacklisted several Chinese officials over a new security law in Hong Kong that Washington claims to be against freedom of speech. China, however, says the law will return stability to the economic hub that has been embroiled in anti-government protests for months. China accuses the U.S. and other Western countries of being behind the protests. Washington has also sided with Beijing's rivals in the maritime dispute over the South China Sea and routinely dispatches warships and warplanes to the region. The two sides are also involved in a bitter trade and cyber wars. During Trump's presidency, the U.S. imposed sweeping tariffs on Chinese imports, prompting tit-for-tat measures from China. Experts believe that there is a bipartisan anti-China sentiment among U.S. politicians.
There's a bipartisan anti-China feeling, not only among the American people, but also in Congress.
The recent moves and statements from the Biden administration suggest that tensions between Beijing and Washington are far from over. Biden's policy on China has so far proven to be different from that of Trump's administration, only in rhetoric, not in kind.
Now let's get down to business. Joining me in this debate show will be analyst and commentator Fabrizio Goldoni out of Hong Kong. And also we'll have with the Asia desk of the Executive Intelligence Review, Mike Billington in Leesburg, Virginia. Good to have both of you, gentlemen. Now let's go to Hong Kong first. Fabrizio, there is a new president at the Oval Office, but we still witness U.S. military moves and deployments in regions China claims sovereignty over or feels threatened. Now, Taiwan and Strait is one of those areas. What's Washington's agenda for Taiwan? Will it heed Beijing's concerns?
The point is this one. If we have to believe to the official statement of the State Department, basically, the State Department on the 3rd of February make a statement, said that it will respect the One China policy. These are words, because actually, on reality, we have seen different attitude. We have seen a U.S. Warship that has been through the Taiwan Strait, despite a lot of objection from China. And this one, of course, is the first real act of the new Biden administration.
Okay, now let me turn to Leesburg, Virginia. Mike, Washington does not seem to want to curb ties with Taiwan, as urged by Beijing. How seriously could a Taiwan issue affect Sino-U.S. relations?
Very, very seriously. Mr. Fabrizio was correct that the State Department said they honored One China, but this was a lower-level spokesman. This was not Anthony Blinken. The new Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, in his testimony to the Congress, was asked about the outrageous lie from Pompeo that there was genocide taking place in Xinjiang. And Blinken said, yes, I agree. So we're dealing here with a return of the most extreme warmongers from the Obama administration, the people who started the wars in Libya and Syria and are committed, in fact, to renewing those wars, to honoring their so-called allies against Russia and against China, and to restart these colonial wars. This is extremely, extremely dangerous. I don't think the warship per se means anything more than a symbol of the fact that they intend to carry on. What has to be noted was that Trump failed. You know, when Trump came in, people forget this already, but the first 2.5 years of his administration, he very strongly defended China. He praised Xi Jinping as a great leader of a great nation. He held meetings with Xi Jinping in Florida. He went to China, had a wonderful visit, and he had the trade war, but the trade difference was something that did have to be resolved. But the problem is that Trump failed. When the coronavirus hit, he was convinced by idiots like Pompeo and Navarro and other anti-China lunatics that he had to blame someone for both the virus and for the fact that the economy went to hell when the virus hit. And he accepted that, and he began this anti-China thing. And Fabrizio is absolutely right. There is a vile anti-China racism in the United States today. People have accepted this, which they would not have accepted had Trump stuck to his actual belief and his actual commitment that we could work with Russia, as he repeated over and over again, and that we could, in fact, work with China and must work with China and Russia, which is what my organization, what the LaRouche organization, has been fighting for from the beginning, to bring together the world's great powers to deal with the extraordinary crisis facing mankind, the pandemic, the financial breakdown crisis, the danger of war, and so forth. Unfortunately, we're dealing now with an administration that is effectively going back to the neocon-type policy, despite being Democrats, of asserting Americans' right to basically wage war wherever we want, to make sanctions wherever we want, and that this is extremely dangerous for mankind. Our organization is committed to fighting this anti-China policy, which is ultimately, it's a racist policy, and that we have to reverse that if we're going to save the U.S. from its current threat of general economic and political and social breakdown.
Mm-hmm. Now, Fabrizio, China-U.S. relations under the Trump administration were mostly fractious, leading to rows and tit-for-tat action over trade, regional security, human rights, and you name it. Will the same dispute go on, you think?
The point is this one. I think that basically there is a bipartisan kind of policy and agreement in the United States. So if a president, I'm talking about the relationship between the U.S. and China, if the president has an approach against China, as Trump has for many different angles, most probably the new one, in different way, he will continue to have a confrontational approach. This is what I think. We mentioned before the neocons. The neocons are definitely bipartisan, you know? I think that we can say clearly that are bipartisan. We have in both the Democrats and the Republican. We have to remember that the pivot to Asia was a project under the Obama administration. Okay. So, in my opinion, there is a little bit different between Trump, but this we are just at the beginning, of course, of the new Biden presidency. The difference is in the approach, you know. In my opinion, Trump was much more focused on trade war, on the imbalance between the import and export and these kind of things, with Biden, especially with some of the senior advisors that he has around, Blinken, but we don't forget Nuland, for example, can bring the conflicts in some area of the world to a real state of a war, not a war of words, but a war of weapons.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mike, you mentioned about this anti-China sentiment that has been in the air in the U.S. is still there. So, given the circumstances, and this is also a bipartisan thing, So which direction do you expect the U.S.-China relations to go?
Well, I don't want to forecast where it's going to go. It's what we are going to do to change this. Fabrizio is absolutely right. And as you probably know, both Mr. Putin and Xi Jinping, in their speeches last week at the World Economic Forum, warned that, in Putin's case, he warned that we're seeing a repeat of the 1930s. And that didn't turn out well, as he put it. Mrs. LaRouche, Helga Zepp LaRouche, who's a German citizen, as you know, the head of our organization, in a broadcast, told people very clearly that she had all her life wondered how a great nation like Germany, a nation of Beethoven and Einstein, could have descended into the Hitlerian hell. And then said, I have the same question about America today. How could this great nation have reached such a despicable point as we are today, with open censorship by the Democrats of a president of the United States and a former president and almost anybody who they're trying to throw people from the supporters of Trump out of the Congress. This is a dictatorial descent into hell in the United States, whether you like Trump or not. Trump failed at many of the things he was committed to doing, which is why he was committed to, like I said, being friends with Russia and China, ending these colonial wars in the Middle East, reviving America's industrial strength. But he didn't make it. He failed, partially because of this crazy Russiagate impeachment, and then this wild anti-China, McCarthyite anti-China hysteria that was built up by Pompeo, by the media, by the Congress. We can and we must make it clear to Americans that the pending global financial breakdown crisis created by the unprecedented printing of money through quantitative easing and so forth, the trillions of dollars being printed to prop up the banks on Wall Street and in the city of London, will blow apart. And we must, if we are going to survive, work with Russia and China on building the world. Just in the COVID, consider the fact that Mr. Osterholm, one of the leading medical professionals, said that the advent of South African, British, and other mutations of the coronavirus is going to cause, he predicted, in the next 2 months, the worst crisis we've seen yet, which exemplifies the fact that if we are going to stop a pandemic, you can't do it in one country. You have to do it in the world. Okay. And we have to work, especially with China and other nations, to achieve that, or we're facing a disaster.
Okay, Fabrizio, Mike is talking about this necessity that the U.S. needs to do this, to, and his organization is trying to bring world powers together to work. Do you think that's possible? Is there enough resolution? Is there the will on the part of the U.S. to do that?
It depends on the attitude they will have from now on, because, let's say, more medicine and less bombs, if I can put in a slogan, no? You know, because, frankly speaking, until now we have seen for many, many years opening of a new front all over the world, you know, a lot of proxy wars, a lot of things. In my opinion, the capability of America is much, much higher than what has been expressed in the last 10, maybe 15, 20 years, you know. This gigantic weapon industry that has been created after the Second World War, for sure is a way also to condition the American policy. And this one, if we just, you know, remember one number, you know, that the American foreign military base, I can say that are around 800, maybe close to 900 around the world. And this one is something that we should consider every day when we wake up, you know? So, I mean, they have 800 bases around the world doing what? And, you know, if you look at China and you look at Russia,
maybe they have three or four bases, you know, in total. So why need to have 800? You know? I think we must arrive to a point where it will be a table and we will start to discuss about some of these hot topic. I will put, for instance, the nuclear proliferation between United States and Russia and say, you know, sit down, see if we can put down the number of vectors, the number of the nuclear weapons, and, you know, we must, because otherwise we run against another war.
Yeah, that the START Treaty was just extended for 5 years for now. Mike, China's top diplomat is asking for both Beijing and Washington to put relations back on a predictable, I'm quoting him, and constructive path. And he's urging the U.S. to stop what he's calling meddling in Chinese internal affairs like Hong Kong and Tibet. Now, that's what China's asking for. What about the U.S.? Would it take heed of that?
Well, that, again, that's our job. There is an attempt now to overthrow both Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin. I mean, you know about the Navalny case, a total fake fraud case. Navalny is a well-known British intelligence operative, and they're using his case to try to stir up an international ferment to throw Putin out. And the same thing is happening with Xi Jinping. The Atlantic Council just issued a document, a paper, saying that they think they can successfully stir up crisis within the leadership in China and get Xi Jinping to be removed, as if he's some sort of a monster. The only way we can change this perception in the United States is force Americans to recognize the unbelievable transformation of China, that not only did it lift 800 million people out of poverty, but through the Belt and Road, an idea, by the way, which was introduced by Lin and Helga LaRouche, but which the Chinese have fully adopted and implemented. They are taking their policy of building infrastructure as a way of escaping poverty into the rest of the world. And the idea that somehow the rest of the world is afraid of China's aggression is the most lunatic idea in the world. The rest of China, of South America and Africa and the rest of Asia, they have some difficulties with China, but they are tremendously grateful that finally there is some powerful force in the world which is going to free them from the poverty at which they were kept for decades, even not only under colonialism, but under the neocolonial policies of the IMF and the World Bank. They were denied infrastructure. This was called inappropriate. They needed appropriate technologies,
right.
Picks and shovels, not dams and high-speed rail. The Chinese are offering development for the first time, and they are delighted. And we as Americans, who in historically was a nation committed to the idea that we would not allow colonialism in the rest of the world, that we would use American system methods, as was last known under Roosevelt,
right,
to develop the infrastructure and the economies of the developing sector. We can and we must join the Belt and Road and work in collaboration with China and Russia and India and Japan and Korea to build the world. This is, it's not going to be easy, not with this senile president and this war party that he's pulled around him, but this is something that we have to take responsibility for here in America and everybody in the world, as Mr. Fabrizi was saying as well.
Okay, now that we'll come to the end of this debate show. Let me thank my guests. We had analyst and commentator Fabrizio Goldoni from Hong Kong and from the Asia Desk of the Executive Intelligence Review, Mike Billington from Leesburg, Virginia.
Epic.
Epic.
Glory.
Glory.
honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Islamic Revolution, inspirer of elites and heroes. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the sixth day of the 10-day dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic Revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and the 20th century. The Islamic civilization has trained bright talents in a variety of fields who have played very effective roles in the history of mankind. They were the choices of people who didn't act for their vested interests, but for the interests of the society and human community. They loved serving fellow humans rather than being hungry for power. The Islamic Revolution, too, paved the way for thriving of talents and capacities in different domains. Thus, the more aged this revolution becomes, the number of elites increases in various fields. Since the advent of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini attached high value to acquisition of sciences and technologies. As the revolution has originated in Islam, acquisition of knowledge enjoys a lofty position in it. Just like Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Khamenei too considers the elites and scientists as the choicest of the society and called them spiritual assets. 20 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi dictator, imposed the 8-year war at the behest of his masters in the East and the West in a vain bid to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. Yet, the wishful thinking of the global arrogance didn't materialize, and the Islamic Iran came from strength to strength as the brave youth poured to the fronts and put their talents into practice. The war was indeed an arena for manifestation of a big variety of capacities among the young generation. The war caused the Iranian nation to rely on its own capabilities in the face of problems and shortages. Before the Islamic Revolution, there was no authority to handle the affairs of the elites and bright talents. But after the revolution, especially during the past two decades, different organizations have been set up for recognition of and support for the elites, and there has emerged a sort of scientific movement in the country. Currently, more than 12,000 elites have been supported by the National Elites Foundation. leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "Today, knowledge in the human level, not just the national level, stands on specific borders. We can have our share in breaking these borders and going forward to broaden borders. We should broaden the border of exploration and knowledge. That I attach value and respect to the elites is because of this view. Our elite can be effective in the state of life, in the state of planning, in the state of the country's progress, and in the state of human progress. The holding of over 10 public meetings with scientific elites and weekly meetings with them shows the leader's high opinion on scientific advancement. According to the statistics, before the Islamic Revolution, Iran had no outstanding scientific at the global level. But in 2016, according to the figures of Web of Science, Iran had 208 scientists among the 1% top scholars in the world. This ranking is conducted on the basis of scientific documents and the studies of world researchers in 22 fields during 10 years. This comes while the scholars of Islamic seminaries are not taken into account in this review. The spectacular breakthroughs in different spheres such as nanotechnology, stem cells, biotechnology, space, and nuclear sciences are witness to high potentials among Iranian youth. During the past years, the United States has left no stone unturned to impede Iran's march toward scientific pinnacles. The U.S. resorted to scientific and technological sanctions against Iran to isolate the country. However, these sanctions exposed the hidden talents of the youth. The domineering system, spearheaded by the U.S., has ceaselessly tried to exploit the wealth and resources of nations for its vested interest. By the same token, it has also tried to put embargoes on science and technology to hinder their way of getting access to wealth and resources. Thus, the elimination of elites and heroes has been put in the agenda of global arrogance and Zionism. That's why, every now and then, they assassinate some of the great scientists and heroes of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The terrorist operations against national heroes such as Martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh can be evaluated in this context. This has been on top of the enemy's agenda since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, when great personalities like martyrs Motahari Beheshti, Mufatteh Rajai, and Bahonar were targeted by a hired terrorist. But contrary to the enemy's wish, the Islamic Republic of Iran has covered the path of honor more strongly and resolutely, with faster steps on the course of advancement.
Iran, IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.